I was 35 at the time, and I was beginning to wonder, where do I belong? I've been a waiter and a dishwasher and a cab driver, and I got an education in a BA at City in business, and I got a master's in theater from SF State, and I wanted to be, going back 12 years now, I wanted to be a good character actor, and I wanted to be body movement and offensive and elocution and addiction and the usual tour of New York studios and Hollywood extra roles and disappointment going to Europe and getting whacked out for 10 months and coming back and trying it again. And I was an office manager, statistician, time and motion man, industrial psychiatrist is what they used to call us. And at the age of 32, I finally decided I didn't want to be an office manager. Wanted to be in theater, didn't have the talent or the luck or the skill to be an actor, and joined the two together and began to produce the Mean Troop, a theater group in San Francisco. And in 65, I was with them, working very hard, the only paid member of the group, full-time member. I had left in 63. I left the Alice Chalmers Manufacturing Company as the regional office manager at a salary of $24,000 a year. And I went to work for the Mean Troop as the producer at $120 a month, because I decided that's what I really would be happiest doing. And for 2 years we struggled along, and in 1965 we just ran flat out of money, and I got to know a lot of the artists in San Francisco and the film people and the rock and roll and jazz people. We had a loft, and wherever there's a loft, people say, can I rehearse here, can I sleep here, can we hang out, can we use it for a political meeting? Snick and Core would meet there, so I got to know a lot of the kids there. I just fell upon the idea of putting it all together and doing a fundraiser, 4-hour theater group. And my feelings then were just to keep the Mean Troop going, even though I was going to leave the Mean Troop. The director, Ronnie Davis, and I had a falling out on the theory of the Mean Troop, that he wanted to go and educate, go into towns and do live theater in Ukiah and Eureka and Sebastopol and whatnot. And I tried to explain to him, I said, you can't just go in there and do Hamlet or Girardot or Sartre and expect them to understand it. You got to go in with Solid Gold Cadillac or The Big Knife or Odets. So we had a falling out, but I decided, let me try to raise some money and then I'm going to leave afterwards. So the first one, at the time, my feelings were that I was leaving the Mean Troop and going into something else in theater somewhere. I wasn't planning on even staying in San Francisco, but I wanted to be a theatrical producer and maybe someday even get back into acting, although I doubted it even at that time. And the first one was in November 6, 1965, this benefit, and which turned out to be the greatest show, for me, the greatest show I've ever produced, because it was the most exciting, because it was the first one, like my first woman, was that you don't forget. The first show was, it was the first time I had seen mass bohemia of San Francisco just come out from under the rocks. And it was guitarist Sandy Bull, Allen Ginsberg, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Peter Orlovsky, The Committee, a Jefferson Airplane, a group called the Warlocks, who became the Grateful Dead, a group called the Charlatans. To give you an idea of the extent to which I did not know anything about rock and roll, some people had called me and had said, we're the family dog, and we'd like to come down and help. And I said, fine, come on down, Groovy. And I put them on the poster for the show with the other acts. I thought it was a dog act. And when they came, I said, and I set the check, where are the animals? And he said, well, we're theatrical producers. We thought we'd help you with this thing. And I didn't know that. I didn't even know who they were. That's how little I knew about the industry. And the evening was just the greatest evening of my life, other than one or two other evenings of my life. Mainly because everybody was real. Nobody spent 3 hours in front of the mirror getting togged out just right, you know. The Levi's are just ripped right in. I got Tony Curtis's curl just right, and the wall paint is just right, and my beads are just right. Everybody came as themselves and they were real. And it was in the loft, we had fruit hanging from the girders, and we took two garbage drums and lined them with aluminum wrap and put like 9 bottles of vodka and 1 can of little orange juice in there, and dishes and the paper clips and pencils. I mean, it was a ridiculous, happy, joyous occasion. I realized that
these people never met each other. Allen Ginsberg never met Jefferson Airplane. Peter Orlovsky never met Bob Nelson, who was a brilliant filmmaker. He made a film called Oh, Them Watermelons, which was a great piece of satire. And the cinematographers in San Francisco came up there, and I said, well, what are you going to do? I didn't know they were coming, but the word of mouth came out, got out. I said, well, we're going to show some loops and slides and whatnot. And all of a sudden, these guys with liquids. And I said, what is that? I said, well, we're a light show. A light show? Psychedelic? I didn't know anything. And there were these filmmakers shooting their films all along on the walls of our theater. And the cops came. We had an incredible time with them. Convinced them. It's a long, too long story to get into. They want to shut us down. And I told them Frank Sinatra was coming, and Belafonte was coming. And they say, we don't believe you. Are you telling me that I'm a liar, Chief? I mean, it was a ridiculous scene. The whole thing ended at about 6:30 in the morning with Ginsberg doing his mantras. We raised, I think, $4,700. And that was going to be it. But we got hundreds of letters and phone calls. Do another one. We don't care what the cause is. It don't have to be in. Let's just get together. And I decided to do another one a couple of months later on December 10th, 65. And I started looking around for a place in the city. And I had a motor scooter at the time, and I found this building that wasn't being used at Fillmore and Geary Street called the Fillmore, which is an old skating rink. And I leased it for $60 on December 10th. And we did another one with a group called the Mystery Trend and the Charlatans and the Airplane, and a group called Grace Slick's Great Society, yes. And one more in January, and then I put two and two together. I said, Jesus Christ, and the ballroom was, the film was available, and I rented it for $450 a month. And I got a friend of mine to lend me some money. My brother lent me some money. And the first show was The Airplane, The Mystery Trend, and I think it was The Charlatan, something like that. And that was it. Jefferson Airplane walks on stage, and we're sold out. And I said to Chip Monk, who was with us at the time, very brilliant tech man, crazy brilliant, I want this, that, and I want this to fly. And he said, that'll cost us $3,000. I said, Chip, well, we're making $13,000 this week or $9,000 this week. We took, give you an example, had a screen, we had film, and the film showed a runway with the wheels of an airplane coming toward you. But Chip built a wrought iron, thin wrought iron airplane, about 8 feet across, with lights on it, magnetically controlled lights. It was dark, it was hanging on stage. We had invisible wire going from the stage up into the balcony. And this plane just hung over the stage, the plane did. The airplane tuned up, and I said to Paul Kantner, I said, when I give you the signal, I want you to start to play. It'll take about 10 minutes. Okay, and I said, I want you to watch the screen. We took the last 10 minutes of the film, King Kong. You know, when he's on top of the Empire State Building, and beating himself, and the plane starts swooping in on him. The plane swooping in on King Kong, it wasn't the airplanes that killed the beast, it was beauty. That was Robert Armstrong, those were his lines. Well, that was the last line of that, and then we switched from that into a runway, and we had the sound fixed in such a way that the plane went, the sound just came this way, and as the plane on the screen hit full, the wrought iron plane on the stage lit up and zoomed over the audience. Just went over their heads, and this whole theater just lit up. As the plane, the top volume on the tape peaked, hit it, Paul, and they went into da 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 da, you know, whatever it is, Somebody to Love, whatever. They just sat there. They were mesmerized. Now, that little stupid shit thing cost, I think it was $2,300. That was the film.